Bones over us. Please be seated.
Ms. Hedge.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will now outline the topic of investigation relating to the contamination of DNA samples that was identified in the Queensland Laboratory in 2008. The contamination was identified as occurring in the extraction phase of the DNA testing and analysis undertaken by the laboratory. In October 2007, the laboratory had implemented the DNA IQ system for extraction. That system is used to extract DNA from biological material. It comprises three steps. First, lysis, which breaks down the cell membranes and proteins holding the DNA in the nucleus and releases the DNA. Second, washing, where the DNA is bound to magnetic beads and washed to remove substances that might inhibit DNA testing. And third, elution, where a liquid is added to make the sample ready for processing. In March 2008, the Queensland Laboratory introduced a partly manual and partly automated process, with the lysis step performed manually and the washing and elution steps performed by the MultiProbe 2 platform known as the MP2. In the first half of 2008, at least five instances of contamination were observed by the laboratory, and OQIs, or opportunities for quality improvement, were raised for each. The contamination was within the batch of samples that were processed together on the MP2 instrument. That is, it was noticed that the same DNA profile was seen in at least one unconnected sample that was processed together. In some batches, it was seen in more than one unconnected sample. That is a highly concerning type of contamination because if not identified as contamination, it could result in a person being identified as having deposited DNA at a crime scene with which they had absolutely no connection. For example, in one case identified during the investigation, an alleged sexual assault victim's profile from an oral sake swab was found in a sample from a swab from the right throttle of a motorbike used in an unlawful use of a motor vehicle case. Those two samples had been near each other on the plate used in the MP2 instrument. Dr. Ingrid Muller gave evidence the week before last about another instance. She was told by a reporter about a time that a sexual assault complainant was questioned about a murder because her DNA from her sexual assault investigation kit found its way into a crime scene sample from a murder investigation. So, Commissioner, you can see from those examples the seriousness of that sort of contamination. The laboratory took this issue very seriously. There was an investigation, a number of audits, and two extraordinary management meetings. The laboratory also obtained an independent expert report. And by 28 July 2008, the laboratory ceased processing of the DNA IQ system and returned to the previous manual processing. The Queensland Police Service and the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions were briefed about the issue. The independent expert report was obtained in November 2008. It concluded that the most likely reason for the contamination was that the seal that covered the samples inside the MP2 instrument was not preventing DNA from one tube from entering other tubes in the same batch. The laboratory also engaged in some retrospective identification of cases that might be affected and retesting. Samples that were affected were identified and retested. The scale of the issue is apparent from that investigation. Could I have on the screen FSS.0001.0060.5723? Is one of the audit reports that was done during the investigation. You can see there in the table the number of batches that were processed in the period that was of concern, which was 23 October 2007 to 28 July 2008. The total number of extraction batches used in that time was 278. 202 of those were released, that is, there was no concern about them. 14 were put on hold and 62 were removed. Each batch has up to 96 samples, but a batch is not always full. And of course, there are negative and positive controls. So as a broad estimate of those 62 batches that were removed and needed further consideration, say if there were 50 samples in each of those batches, that might be up to around 3,000 samples, which needed consideration and retesting. The laboratory did that and ensured that every case that might have been affected was reviewed. There was addendum statements produced for the use by the QPS and the DPP. Your commission procured Professor Lindsay Wilson-Wild to consider the methods employed by the laboratory, both before and after this issue arose, and the investigation undertaken by the laboratory. She's provided an expert report, which can I have on the screen, exp.0002.0005.0001. This is the report dated 20 October 2022. Can I turn to paragraph 26 of that report, which appears on page 4? Thank you. In paragraph 26 to 32, Professor Wilson-Wild's opinion is that the laboratory's use of the DNA IQ system before this issue arose in the start of 2008 was not consistent with best practice because the verification of the system that underpinned it was not performed appropriately. So in paragraph 26 and 27, Professor Wilson-Wild concludes that the volumes used in the Queensland lab were far larger than those in the manufacturer's protocol. And at paragraph 31, she concludes that the verification done of that method was insufficient to test those larger volumes. In paragraph 32, Professor Wilson-Wild identified that in the verification, this is in the second sentence, significantly, it is noted that one of the runs was invalidated due to the presence of an unknown profile that could not be identified. That should have resulted in further testing. So that is, it may be, and of course there wasn't further testing, but that was a contamination check. So it may be that the contamination issue that arose later was actually identified in the verification, but not sufficiently investigated to ensure that the platform wasn't creating that problem. And in paragraph 30, Professor Wilson-Wild concludes that the use of high volumes may have contributed to the contamination events. So while the verification was not done in accordance with best practice, Professor Wilson-Wild did find that the investigation of the problem was performed in accordance with best practice. Could we turn to paragraph 49 of the report, please? In that paragraph, she finds that ceasing to use the process while the investigation continued, reintroducing it later, and the investigation into the problem was of a high standard and appropriate and consistent with best practice. Could we turn now to paragraph 63, please? Thank you. Professor says there that the research conducted into the root cause of the contamination was extremely thorough. It is evident that the cause was complex and multi-sourced. Full review was required, and that was the approach taken by Queensland Health Forensic and Scientific Services and was reasonable and appropriate. Finally, can we turn to the impact on results? We turn to paragraph 65 to 69 first, please. The question that was asked here is whether the obtaining of a usable DNA profile was reliable and accurate. That is, whether you do obtain one when you should and not obtain one when you shouldn't, as opposed to the accuracy of that profile, which was the second question. And in these paragraphs, Professor Lindsay Wild concludes that after the retesting and the investigation was done, none of the results released cause a concern about reliability or accuracy. And then in paragraph 70 and 71, that second question is asked whether the actual profiles obtained were reliable and accurate. And because of their extensive review and retesting, the results that were released could be considered reliable and accurate. So there is no ongoing concern that results obtained during that period, there's no concern about their reliability or accuracy. Professor Wilson Wild did identify some aspects of the laboratory's operations during this period which fell below best practice, as well as the verification that we've discussed. At paragraph 36, thank you. Professor Wilson Wild identifies that the training manual for the off-deck lysis, which means the manual lysis followed by the automated washing and elution steps, was introduced in March 2008, but the training manual was not updated until August 2008. And that is a matter that falls below best practice, because the training manual will, of course, be relevant to any staff using the process. In paragraph 48, Professor Wilson Wild indicated that she expected to see a greater clarity in the standard operating procedures for cleaning about the deep clean procedure and records of them being undertaken, and that deep clean should be done on a monthly basis. Of course, when contamination is the issue, the cleaning of the environment is a key feature to ensure that it is right before anyone is concerned about particular instruments. Finally, at paragraph 57, there are some comments from Professor Wilson Wild about a particular audit report, in that it's not clear from that report what was actually conducted as part of the audit or the method of it, and that further information should be included to assist other scientists who read audit reports to determine whether there's some systemic issue, whether there's some overlap with other audits that have been done, whether the audit has been done appropriately. So those three features were identified by Professor Wilson Wild underneath her overall conclusion that the investigation was of a high standard and in accordance with best practice. Commissioner, while no significant failing was found in the investigation and resolution of the issue, and there's no concern about the reliability of results produced by the laboratory in that period, this issue provides a useful foil for the sperm microscopy investigation conducted between 2016 and 2020. That is, there is a significant difference that can be seen between the two investigations in terms of, first, the urgency with which the issues were addressed. Secondly, the use of the OQI and audit procedure in this case compared to the project procedure in the other case. The length of time that it took to come to firm conclusions about cause. The ceasing of the compromise process in this case, once the error was identified, which occurred fairly quickly, as opposed to in the sperm microscopy case, and the identification of all samples that had been affected by the compromise process and retesting for those samples, which is not a step that had been undertaken up to just last week in the sperm microscopy case. We have a list of documents that we intend to tender that's been disclosed to the parties. If we can put that on the screen, it's EXP.0002.0006.0001. Could I tender, Commissioner, that document as an exhibit?
Exhibit 128.
And then could I tender the documents contained in that index, not including those which already have an exhibit number, as a separate exhibit, as a bundle?
Exhibit 129.
None of the parties or counsel assisting require any oral evidence on this topic. So this opening and the documents in the index will form the basis of the public evidence on this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hodge will call the first witness.
Commissioner, the first witness is Ms. Keller.
Yes. Keller, will you take an oath or make an affirmation?
An oath.
Do you swear by Almighty God that the evidence that you shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Thank you. Could you state your full name?
Lara Jane Keller.
And what is your occupation?
I'm currently the Acting Executive Director of Forensic and Scientific Services.
Thank you. And you've given, I think, three statements to the Commission, is that right?
Yes.
And I'll just bring those up in turn. Could we first bring up WIT.0017.0003.0001? So you see, that's a statement of yours. And I think if we go to page ending in .0051, you'll see that one's dated the 20th day of September 2022. And you've reviewed that statement recently?
Yes.
And is it true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
As far as I know, yes.
Thank you. There are no corrections to it?
No, I don't believe so, no.
Commissioner, I tender that first statement of Ms. Keller.
Exhibit 130.
And then you've given a further two statements in the last few days, and you just need to give me a moment to bring up the doc ID. So the first is WIT.0017.0248.0001. And I think, as you note there, you've also participated in an interview with the Commission. You can see that in paragraph one. Could we go, Mr. Operator, to, and I'll just give you the correct page for it. Could we go to page 42 of that statement? You see, this is a statement that you gave on the 21st of October 2022.
Yes.
And again, you've obviously reviewed that recently.
Yes.
And are there any corrections to that statement?
I don't believe so.
And it's true and correct to the best of your knowledge and
yes.
belief?
Yes.
Thank you. I tender that statement, Commissioner. I should say I tender them together with their exhibits or attachments.
Exhibit 131.
And then you gave another statement yesterday. Can we bring up WIT.0017.0249.0001? And this is a short statement. I think if we go over the page, we can see the date of it. That's dated the 23rd of October 2022. That was yesterday.
Yes.
And this was prompted by finding an email
yes.
in your records. And we'll come back to that later, but again, this is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief.
Yes.
I tender that statement, Commissioner.
Exhibit 132.
Thank you. Now, before we go to your statements, Ms. Keller, I just want to ask you some general questions about the management of the lab and your knowledge of what's been going on during the commission. Have you been following the evidence that's come out during the commission?
As best I've been able to, yes.
And you know that one of the witnesses who was called was Helen Gregg?
Yes.
And she's the quality manager for FSS?
She is.
And as we understand her evidence, she has no forensic DNA experience?
I don't believe so.
And were you aware of that when you started in the role as executive director or acting executive director?
Yes, I have worked with Helen over the years.
And she has responsibility for a number of areas?
She does.
And are you aware that in her evidence she wasn't able to identify one proactive action that she'd taken in relation to the DNA analysis unit in the 5 years leading up to the commission?
I don't recall her saying that.
Are you aware that she described herself as a reactive quality manager?
I don't think I heard her say that.
Are you...
Commissioner, could I ask the witness, please, just speak up for those of us in the cheap seats?
Sorry.
That's all right. Take your time, Ms. Keller. And there are counsel everywhere who need to hear.
Do you
might adjust the microphone to and get a bit closer to the microphone and point it at your at yourself. That's good. Thank you.
I think the chair is fixed.
The chair doesn't move.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. I think it's getting. I think it's better now.
Thank you.
Do you have a view about what kind of role you would expect the quality manager to play?
For an organisation as big as FSS, I think that her role would be to oversee accreditation and compliance for the whole campus, which is quite broad. So rather than being a working with each unit specifically because they all have quality officers. Well, a lot of them do, I believe.
I see. Do you have a view about whether the quality management ought to be reactive or proactive?
Oh, always should be proactive.
And so in saying that, what would you envisage as proactive steps that the quality manager ought to be taking in relation to either FSS in general or the DNA lab specifically?
My understanding of the role of a quality manager, and I've been one in the past, is that you schedule audits, you follow up, you look for trends, you do root cause analyses, and generally you're doing that in advance so that you can identify if there are any issues, so that you can take the preventive action rather than the corrective action.
Over the course of the last almost a year now that you've been in the role, have you turned your mind to whether the quality management in relation to the DNA lab is adequate?
I haven't had the opportunity to assess it in any depth. I was confident there was a quality manager and a quality officer.
Are you content with the quality management oversight of the forensic DNA lab in Queensland?
I am.
I see.
I think we've got some things we can learn from the Commission.
And in saying that you're content with it, I'm interested in understanding, does that mean you've looked over the course of the last year at, and we'll take Ms. Gregg specifically, what things, if any, she's done in relation to quality management for the lab?
Sorry, could you say that again?
Yes, to take Ms. Gregg specifically, have you looked over the course of the last year at what things specifically she's done in relation to quality management of the lab?
She's overseen a number of assessments that have happened on campus, and that helps, that prepares the laboratories for, you know, the technical assessor visits. I think she's undertaken some audits. I'd have to go back and have a look at the records on that. Her role is more of an advisory kind of role for the different areas. So certainly she and I have talked a lot about improving aspects like training, which I see as part of the quality system. So she's been very proactive in that space.
I see. I suppose... obviously, you know there is a quality manager. I'm interested in understanding, beyond knowing that there is a quality manager, informing the view that you're content with the quality management in relation to the lab, what understanding you have of what the quality manager has actually done over the course of the last year.
I would have to go back through my records on that, including the CSP records. I mean, there's always room to improve. So, you know, content is probably a word that, you know, we can always improve. That's the whole idea of a quality system, is to look for improvement.
You mean that by the use of the word contented, you don't mean that you're complacent?
No.
Or that you believe everything's perfect. It is that you, I take it, you believe that the system's in place adequate to pick up and anticipate error?
Yes, Commissioner.
And so just in agreeing with the Commissioner or adopting those words from the Commissioner, what I'm interested in understanding is, beyond knowing that there is a quality manager, how have you satisfied yourself that there are systems in place that are adequate for picking up and preventing error?
So I'm aware that within a quality system, it's got many, many facets. So, depending upon the standard that you're complying with, there's a multitude of different aspects that a quality system can oversee. So from down in the laboratory, talking about things like the quality controls, the external quality assurance, the training, the competency, and then you overlay things like audits and client satisfaction and those kinds of aspects to ensure that the quality of the results or accuracy of the results matches with the client needs. So it's all encompassing when we talk about the different standards. So I trust that based upon the fact that we're NADA accredited, which is that doesn't go into every single process in every single laboratory, it can't. But the fact that we remain accredited gives me a sense of confidence that the system is in place.
We'll come to NADA accreditation in a moment. At the moment, I just want to focus on the quality management system. And I think you described Ms. Gregg's role as an advisor.
In most respects, I think it's more an advisory role rather than, because we have a number of quality officers in place.
So who is it, if anyone, with quality oversight who could intervene in relation to a process?
It would be the quality manager in consultation with the quality officer. So I would expect within the laboratory, the quality officer would be the one who would oversee, for example, signing off temperature records on a monthly basis, that kind of thing. And then you would have your quality manager that would, as part of the overall oversight of the quality system, would, monitor that as well.
So it would be Ms. Gregg who could intervene?
Yes, or Dr. Scott in this case.
We'll come to Dr. Scott in a moment. Are you aware of Ms. Gregg having intervened in relation to any quality issue in the lab?
Not that I can recall.
Are you aware of her intervening in relation to quality issues in other parts of forensic and scientific services?
Not that I can recall.
When you reflect, as I assume you have, on what happened in relation to the ceasing of processing of samples in the DIFP range, that is 0.001 nanograms to 0.0088 nanograms, do you regard that as a failure of quality management?
I think it depends. It depends on how we got to that point. So not necessarily a failure, but I think certainly hindsight has given us the opportunity to revisit a lot of the science here.
I understand you've had the opportunity now to revisit things. Perhaps we might need to break this down a little bit. When you say revisit the science here, what does that mean?
Well, from the moment that I've arrived there, say from March, there's been some discussions or differences of scientific opinion that, appear to have become louder, and that's a good thing in terms of improvement. I guess now we have an opportunity to look at those various processes with a different lens. So, and we would, it's incumbent upon us now to do that.
Perhaps if I try to frame it in a slightly simple way, do you think that if there was adequate quality management in relation to FSS, that it would have picked up at a much earlier time the issue in relation to not processing samples in the DIFP range?
Possibly.
And is that a view that you've held for a long time or just formed now as I've been asking you questions?
I've only been here for a very short time. What I've been hearing makes me concerned about the quality system. So this is our opportunity.
You mean the evidence in the commission has made you concerned about that?
The comments from some of the scientific staff has made me question.
We'll come to this in due course during the day, but what I want to try to understand as best we can is whether you have identified or identified at any earlier point in time in your tenure that there was an issue with quality management given what had happened in relation to DIFP processing. And if so, when? And if so, what you've done about it? So can you help us with that?
I think it's easy to look back, you know, with a different lens. I think had I known and had I had the opportunity to spend time investigating what was happening in that particular part of the laboratory, then I may have formed a different view. I think, you know, I was in a position where I trusted that the people who were doing the quality jobs were doing them correctly. So I think that they have done their best.
Let me then ask about the role of Dr. Scott. Do you know what rank Dr. Scott holds?
Rank?
Yeah, so what position she holds, what level she's at?
Well, she's a health practitioner. I'm not sure whether she's a 5 or a 6. I believe she may be a 5, level 5.
And so if she's a HP 5, she would report to a HP 6?
Yes.
And do you know who she reports to?
I'm trying to picture the chart. I think she reports through to the team leader of evidence recovery, which would be Ms. Brizzotto.
Okay, who's an HP6?
Correct.
And then in turn, Ms. Brizzotto reports to Ms. Allen?
Correct.
Who's a HP7?
Yes.
And then Ms. Allen reports to you?
Yes.
And Ms. Gregg is also a HP6?
Correct.
And she reports to you?
She does.
And so do you know what authority, if any, Dr. Scott has to overrule or pause processes?
I don't know.
Okay. Have you ever, in the course of the last now 11 months, have you investigated that at all?
No.
And to come back to the question I'm interested in trying to understand at this point, which is your view about the adequacy of quality management oversight, do you regard that as an adequate process for quality management within the DNA lab?
Yes.
Why?
Because I guess I've been in a situation where I've seen this all happening, right? If I had, it's easy for me to be able to look back and judge what was happening there. I've been going through it at the same time, so it would be easy to say, to ask why I perhaps might not have done such and such, but I guess I was confident at the time that there were processes in place, that we were abiding by the standards. So I guess we're in a situation now where we, you know, we've got an opportunity to revisit that.
Step back for a moment from the particular issue that had happened in relation to DIFP.
Right.
Do you regard the quality management function within the lab as adequate if Ms. Gregg does not appear to be a proactive manager and has responsibility for many different areas, as you've noted, and Ms. Scott, Dr. Scott, reports to somebody who reports to Ms. Allen and has no independent authority to pause or do anything on the basis of quality issues.
That's a lot that you just said.
Is there a part of it that you didn't understand? Because I'll take
it in
turn.
Would you mind putting it again?
I understood what you said.
Understand it?
Yeah, so I'll, as I understand the quality management function within the, in relation to the lab, it has, there are two people who have responsibility. One is Ms. Gregg. Is that right?
Yes.
And the other is Dr. Scott.
Yes.
And Ms. Gregg is a reactive manager. That's not meant as a criticism of her, but that's the reality where she has responsibility over a number of different areas.
I would not consider her to only be reactive. I think she is proactive also. If I could just add something, you know, scientific practice means that everybody in the laboratory is responsible for the quality, not just two people. Now, each scientist that is doing a test is responsible for the quality. That's part of our role. So I just want to clarify that, it's because in a laboratory environment, we're all responsible.
I'm not disagreeing with mm-hmm. you about that, but you have a specific quality management function mm-hmm. for a yes. reason, presumably.
Yes, it's part of the standard.
You don't just have somebody there arbitrarily. So they have a role, and I want to understand your view as to whether their discharge of the role and the setup in relation to it is adequate. So Ms. Gregg, she has responsibility. I understand you disagree with the characterisation of her as reactive.
I do.
She has responsibility for many areas.
She does.
And Dr. Scott reports to somebody who reports to Ms. Allen and does not have independent authority over quality management. She can't stop processes or intervene or act anyway independently.
I don't know whether she can or not. I would hope that she would be able to speak up if she identified something.
But you understand there's a difference, don't you, between being able to speak up
mm-hmm.
and having independent authority to be able to do something.
Yes.
So she doesn't have, you don't think that she has some independent authority in relation to the lab?
No.
And quality control?
No.
So, and you're a scientist. That's right. Sorry, you'll just have to.
I was.
I see. In any event, you have scientific training.
I do.
Do you regard the setup of the quality management function as adequate? And if so, why, having regard to what we've just talked about as to the roles of the two people who are responsible for that function?
I believe it's adequate.
And doing the best you can for us, why, having regard to the roles of Ms. Gregg and Dr. Scott?
Because I, up until this point in time, I've had no reason to second guess what they're doing.
I see. Let me then ask you about.
But I understood, Ms. Keller, from your earlier answer
mm-hmm.
that you didn't know whether Dr. Scott had authority to overrule.
No, that's true.
Why would you have had reason to regard them as adequate? I can understand if you hadn't thought about it, but you didn't actually have any basis upon which to think that the processes in place to ensure the maintenance of quality and reliability were adequate, because you didn't know what they were doing or what they could do.
Well, when I say adequate, I mean we were complying with our NADA inspections. I was not made aware of any glaring issues with regards to QC or external QAP. So on that basis, I considered that the quality system was functional.
I understand.
Can I ask one other thing related to that then? Have you done any research or have any expertise in relation to what is an adequate quality management system?
Not research as such.
Have you got an understanding of what constitutes an adequate quality management system?
Yes.
And what would be the necessary components of an adequate quality management system?
So as I said before, there's a number of different components, and I'm just thinking through the standard of the, you know, so you have to have all sorts of things like, you know, appropriate supervision in place. You need to have audits. You need to have training records, competency records, processes for managing complaints and client feedback. You need to be able to undertake various assessments of performance. You need to assess your stakeholders in terms of who you send your samples to, those kinds of things. It's quite, the standards are a dry read, but there's a lot in there.
And when you say the standards, which standards are you referring to?
Well, I'm most familiar with 15189, but I'm aware that DNA is credited to 17025.
Okay. We'll come to that. You're talking about the ISO standards.
Yes.
Is that right? We'll come to that in a moment. And I just want to check, though, whether we're not at cross purposes. I was asking if you have an understanding of what is an adequate quality management function, and you were talking about the ISO standard.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to check that whether you're answering the question or whether you've understood the question I'm asking. Insofar as you have an understanding of what constitutes an adequate quality management function, is that based on your understanding of an international standard?
It's how you implement the requirements of that standard. So it's fine just to have a standard that says that you must address complaints, but an effective quality system will have that complaint fully investigated to root cause and feedback. So that's where you assess whether it's effective or not. Just having the requirement for it doesn't mean it's going to be effective. It's how you execute that.
And so assuming your view is, as I understand it, that the ISO standard or whatever the relevant ISO standard is that applies requires a root cause analysis, and being able to undertake a root cause analysis is an indication of good quality management. Have you satisfied yourself or looked at whether or not that occurs in the FSS?
Not to that level of detail, no.
To any level of detail?
Not in my current role.
And when you refer to, was it ISO 15189 that you...
Oh, that's a clinic, that's a laboratory one. Yes.
But was that when you started talking about a standard before, that was the one that you were referring to that you're familiar with?
They're very similar.
That's the one that applies for human pathology lab accreditation?
Yes.
And that's one you're familiar with from your previous role?
I am familiar with 17025 and 9001 as well.
And 17025 is the one that the DNA lab is accredited against?
I believe so.
And what do you understand that's a standard for?
That's a general laboratory kind of standard.
So tell me if you agree with this, ISO 17025 is an international standard for testing and calibration laboratories.
I don't know what the exact title of it is.
It's not specific to forensic science?
Oh, no, I don't believe so.
It's certainly not specific to DNA analysis?
I don't believe so.
It provides for standard levels of processes to be in place for standard laboratory testing regimes?
I believe so.
And are you aware that there's an Australian standard for forensic analysis?
No.
AS 5388?
Okay.
You're not aware of that?
No.
I see. And you've referred to NATA accreditation. Were you aware that NATA can accredit against that standard?
No.
What's the number of the standard again, Mr. Hodge?
It's AS 5388.
Thank you.
And you, am I right in thinking you sit on the executive committee of, is it ANZPA? How do you?
Oh.
The Australian and New Zealand, what is it, it's PAA?
It's policing. Policing agency and authority, I can't recall. I have to have a look. It's all a bunch of acronyms.
Did you know that the Australian, or I'm assuming you didn't know, that the Australian Standard for Forensic Analysis involved that organisation that you sit on the executive committee for?
I presume so now, based on what you've said.
And it's published on their website.
Okay.
But this takes you by surprise.
Not necessarily, because of the complexity across FSS, and there's probably many standards that we comply with that I'm not familiar with.
And the NATA accreditation that's undertaken for the Queensland DNA lab, I understand your view is that demonstrates the adequacy of the lab's processes.
That's one mechanism to assess it, not the only one.
So are you familiar with what accreditation by NADA has involved for the Queensland lab?
No, I haven't participated in that.
I see. And so how did you form the view that NADA accreditation was a reassurance about the quality of the lab without understanding what it is that NADA accredited the lab against?
I guess it's, you know, I have to trust my people and that's what I did.
And when you say trust your people, who are the people you're referring to?
The people who were in management positions responsible for the laboratory function and the quality system.
Does that mean, I'm assuming one of those people is Kathy Allen?
Yes.
And who are the other people that you're referring to that you trusted?
All of the managers that are responsible for the quality of the work that's provided.
I suppose perhaps if we might approach it in a different way. Did somebody assure you that the fact of NADA accreditation was a good indicator that the as to the quality of the processes used within the Queensland DNA lab?
I may have come to that view myself.
I see.
I see it as one part of the process.
I suppose then perhaps just to come back to, I'd asked you about how you'd formed the view that you were satisfied that NADA accreditation demonstrated the fitness of the laboratory processes, and you said, I suppose I have to trust my people, and I'm just interested in understanding what the connection is. How does trusting your people explain why it is that you are satisfied about NADA accreditation without understanding what standard NADA accredited the lab against?
So I trust them to do their jobs, and part of that is to fulfil the various accreditation requirements. So I was confident that that's what was happening.
Oh, I see. You trusted that they would fulfil whatever the accreditation requirements were.
Yes.
But that does seem to bring us back to the question of, perhaps I can put it in a different way. Do you think in your role you ought to have familiarised yourself with what was involved in NADA accreditation for the DNA lab?
In hindsight, yes.
And before today, is that a thought that's occurred to you?
There's lots of things I could have become more familiar with, so.
Now, I want to then turn to some of the detail of what happened in relation to these DIFP samples and your involvement with them. I understand you started in the role as acting executive director in, was it October or November of last
October.
October of last year. And can you tell us When was the first time after you'd started in your role that anyone raised with you there being an issue about the lab not processing samples between 0.001 nanograms per microliter and 0.0088 nanograms per microliter?
So I can't actually recall exactly when. People certainly were speaking to me. Obviously, we now know the people that were speaking with me. That was when I first became aware or I was being told that there was some concern around that DIFP process. So that would have been around March.
March of this year?
Yes.
Well, let's just go back a step. You were copied into emails with the police last year.
Yes.
So presumably you must have at least become aware of the issue last year when you got emails from the police.
Yes. I'm seeing those as two different things. So I'm seeing the contact that we had or that I was brought into with Inspector Neville was talking about the threshold in general, rather than the process of the DIFP in the laboratory. So to me, they're two different things. So certainly I was aware and I had been copied in to Inspector Neville's correspondence with Ms. Allen at where he, excuse me, my understanding was that he was questioning the threshold and was asking for more information around that. So I was aware of that. But at that time, I did not know, I had no understanding of what was happening in the laboratory with those three baskets of results. I was not aware of that at that stage. So I later became aware of that.
So when you say what was happening in the laboratory in relation to those three baskets of results, could you just explain that?
So I can't recall when it was, but there was a conversation and Ms. Allen described it very well to me so I could understand it, that there was three different baskets of results. So there was the less than 0.001 basket where I was led to believe there was essentially no DNA present. And then there was the 0.001 to 0.0088 where there was, small amount of DNA present, and I didn't understand the spectrum of that at the time. And then there was the everything higher than that. So that's what I mean when I say about the three baskets. I didn't know at that stage how each of those was processed in the laboratory. I've subsequently become aware to some extent as to how that's done.
And I may have misunderstood your evidence, but I thought you were saying when some scientists came to raise issues with you, you understood their issue to be about the process in the lab for what you described as the three buckets.
So relating to the threshold value and whether or not there was additional processing done. At that stage, I didn't realise what that additional processing was. And at that stage, I was under the belief that at any time in the process, one of the scientists in the laboratory or a member of the police could ask for additional work to be done. So I understood that Inspector Neville was asking about the thresholds, and then by the time those people came and had a talk to me about their concerns, then I thought they were two different things at the time.
Okay, well,
that is to say, you didn't link them.
I didn't. Mm. I didn't because I don't know if it's Inspector Neville referred to a particular case or a particular program of work, and so I called that particular, and the rest.
Yes, so you didn't appreciate then that what the scientists were speaking about and what Neville was speaking about were different perspectives on the same process.
I did not.
Hmm.
come back to that then, but can you tell us when you came to realise that they were talking about the same thing?
Gee, no, I can't tell you exactly. I guess it's sort of evolved over the time that I've been there, that I've sort of become more aware of the different aspects. I can't tell you an exact date, I'm sorry.
Had you realised by June?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so you realised by June that the scientists and the police were talking about the same thing?
Facets of the same thing, yes.
And you think the scientists first came to you in March, is that right?
That's when the first more formalised conversation took place. I had a very informal conversation with one of the scientific staff. I can't remember if it was late. It was in December or it was January. And we had said we'd been to a meeting and we'd been talking about the possibility, I think it was possibility of a review. And I'd had an informal conversation where they'd said, well, there was some report and not everyone agreed. Well, this person didn't necessarily agree with it. So it was all sort of very piecemeal back then.
That was Kylie Ricker?
No, that was actually Rhys Parry.
Oh, I see. Rhys Parry had raised his issue.
We had a really informal conversation where I'd asked him about something and then he said that he had been asked to provide his opinion on a program of work, which at that stage I didn't know which one it was.
And do you remember when you first spoke to Kylie Ricker about, that's what my frame of very general opinion, about an issue in the lab?
Are you talking about a scientific issue?
Yeah,
oh, okay. So Miss Ricker would come and have a chat every now and then. And I guess we first had a conversation, I think, about just the general management team interactions and things like that. And I was led to believe that that Miss Ricker was had some different views to some of the other managers. So we talked about that. I believe we also talked about the restructuring of the different teams, her team and another team, and there was a little bit of concern about why that happened. So we talked about those kinds of things. pardon me. And then Kylie, earlier this year, bought me quite a bit of information, which was subsequently part of what we'll probably talk about with the ESU referrals. So it was a combination of workplace happenings and then the scientific information.
You think it wasn't until this year that she raised an issue about scientific issues, or you're not sure?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'd have to go back and have a look at my records, but certainly nothing formal that way that I can recall.
Do you remember whether at some stage when she came and spoke to you, she told you about keeping a spreadsheet about results?
I received a copy of that later and that was submitted to ESU.
I see. And that was, when you say later, that was in March, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And what did you understand the spreadsheet was about?
I thought, I didn't really understand, but what I thought she was doing was she was looking at different cases to try and identify if there were any inconsistencies. I didn't understand what it said. She had said to me that that a few of them were looking at that and that they were essentially, I believed, were going to provide that to more senior managers for assessment. I don't believe I received a copy of that until when the submission was made, which was included in that submission.
I see. And when you say the submission, you're talking about in March, the submission to ESU.
I am.
And at an earlier point in time, she told you that she and some other scientists have been preparing a spreadsheet.
I think so.
And you think she told you they were going to submit it to more senior managers?
That's what I thought.
The more senior managers would presumably be Justin Howes and Cathy Al.
I would have thought so.
And you already knew by then that there was, regardless of whose fault it was, there were significant personality issues between Cathy Allen and Justin Howes on the one hand and Ms. Rico.
I got the impression that there was sort of two different groups within the leadership team. It was Kylie with, you know, with her team, and then, you know, Cathy and Justin with their team. So I would have still expected them to work together.
Did you have the view that Ms. Allen had an approach to management which you described as command and control?
Yes.
And could you just explain to the Commissioner what you mean by that?
So my view is that a hierarchical sort of command and control where only one person makes the decisions on behalf of everyone, or that people are managed such they have little, their voice is not loud enough, or if they, it's almost as though they're, everything has to be run through a particular person in order to be approved, for example. That's a very, to my mind, old-fashioned view, management style. So when I realised, well, I took the view that that's how that laboratory was being run, it didn't sit with me because that's not my style. So that's why I would say that everything kind of would go through Cathy. You don't necessarily get the best outcomes from that approach.
And that's a view you formed very early in taking up your position?
Within the first couple of months.
So that is last year?
Yes.
And that's just while we're on that issue. Do you remember very soon after you started, you intervened to take control of work from home arrangement?
Oh, yes.
And that was, within about a week of you starting in the role?
I don't know. That may have been.
Was it very early?
It was pretty early.
And was it the case that before your intervention, those arrangements were controlled by Ms. Allen?
And the individual line managers at that time, yes.
And you stepped in to say they should now come to you for approval?
I made the decision that I wanted to see, I wanted to be able to understand, you know, what was being requested. And at that stage, I don't recall exactly when, but people had been starting to say to me they felt that things weren't as flexible as they would like. So I therefore asked if they could all come to me. And it wasn't just the forensic DNA, it was the whole of the leadership team I made that request.
But were the issues in relation to just DNA or just generally in relation to?
Mainly DNA lab.
And those are issues that you were alerted to, what, almost immediately after you started the role?
Fairly soon after I started.
And only by staff members complaining to you, or was there some sort of feedback you were receiving from other parts of Queensland Health?
I can't recall when it was, but I did have a conversation with the HR, because I had regular conversations with our HR expert, and they said that they considered that the practice of managing the flexible work arrangements was less than contemporary.
In the DNA lab?
Yes.
And was that when you started or soon after you started, or you're not sure?
I'd have to go back to my notes. I think it was fairly early on.
And so that was what prompted you to step in, along with receiving complaints from staff members? Or was it just the fact that you'd received the feedback from HR?
It was a combination of things. And subsequently, when I would receive a flexible work arrangement request, I felt that there was perhaps a higher level of rigour for those particular ones than for other parts of FSS. So that's when I sort of thought, well, I need to understand what's happening here.
I see. So then to move forward again, at some stage, and I'm just trying to pin down the timing from your perspective, at some point earlier than March, Ms. Rica has told you that she and some other scientists in the lab have been preparing a spreadsheet where they identify results where there's an issue.
Yes.
And you didn't, I've understood you to say you didn't know exactly what, we didn't understand exactly what the issue was.
No.
And how early do you think she told you this?
I don't know. I don't know exactly when that was. She was someone that would come and she came to see me fairly early on.
Could it have been at the end of last year that she told you that?
Quite possibly.
And Dr. Muller, you know her as well.
Hmm.
And do you recall she emailed you last year?
I would need to see the details. I don't know.
I'll show you the email. Can we bring up fss.0001.0083.0035R, so the redacted version?
Oh, this was about the, just let me have a look here. Yes. So that was when I mentioned earlier about the team, the constitution of the different teams, then yes, that's what this was, as far as I can recall, about.
And so she sent you an email on the 28th of October 2021 and said, in 2017, a staff member left because of bullying issues. She was attempting to bring to light a significant issue with sperm detection on alleged sexual assault samples. Problems with practices and procedures are ongoing.
Yes, I can see that.
And did that prompt you to investigate what that was about?
That's a very vague statement, so no.
Sorry, what is the vague statement? The problems with processes and procedures are ongoing.
Yes, that doesn't have much detail, or any detail really, so I didn't know at that stage, bearing in mind I'd arrived 4 weeks previously, what that actually meant.
So did you ask her?
I don't recall.
You don't recall whether you asked her?
We were talking, no, I don't, because we were talking about the team composition at the time with this.
Did you find out what the issue was with sperm detection on alleged sexual assault samples?
Not at that stage, no.
I assume you don't regard that as a vague statement.
No, but my understanding from that was that that was well before my tenure and I would have hoped it would have been addressed.
She says she was attempting to bring to light a significant mm-hmm. issue with sperm detection on alleged sexual assault samples. Problems with process and procedures are ongoing. I'm struggling with this one. You thought the statement about sperm detection was specific, but that was from before your time. And then you thought problems with process and procedures are ongoing was too vague. So you don't know whether you did anything about it.
At that stage, I had just arrived, so I did not know. I didn't know anything about any of this at the time.
Oh, I accept that. Wouldn't know, but really the issue is you've just arrived and one of the scientists tells you that problems with process and procedures are ongoing, and she's speaking as somebody who's engaged in the provision of evidence in criminal trials. So the issue is, having received that upon your arrival, I would think that you'd immediately find out what this was all about, because it might be nothing, it might be a disgruntled employee, but it might be something serious. So, but you didn't.
Looking back on that now, that's a fair assessment.
And just doing the best you can for us.
Why didn't you do it?
I'm not actually going to sit here and make excuses for the workload, et cetera, et cetera. So it was not done. Looking back, should I have done that? Probably. Did I? No. Would I do it differently? Yes.
Do you receive copies of the management meeting minutes from the DNA lab?
No. Nope.
I see. So how do you get informed about what has been considered by the management team?
By Kathy.
And by written updates or verbal?
We would meet on a fairly regular basis.
I see. And I'm interested in just understanding one thing. Can we bring up WIT.0006.0115.0001? And so these are the minutes of the management team meeting on the 11th of November, 2021. Can we just go to page 7 of that document? And you see item 8.1 is DNA insufficient for processing process?
Yes.
And the person whose initials are next to it is Kylie Rika?
I presume that's her initials.
And you see what's referred to there is Ms. Rika collecting samples where better results obtained after case manager requested concentration, including profiles for NSID. General discussion ensued that this possibility was communicated and accepted by QPS and that they could request processing any time, that the case manager may rework if case circumstances indicate worthwhile. And I'm just interested in knowing whether Kathy Allen reported back to you that this issue of what was going on with DIFP samples was also something that within her management team they were raising as an issue.
Not at that time, no.
At any time?
I don't recall that, no.
Okay. And then that's already been tendered, Commissioner, so I don't need to tend to that. Can we then bring up, now, I'm sorry, I don't have a doc ID for it because these are exhibits from Ms. Keller's statement, so I'll just need to give you the exhibit number and I'm hoping it'll be possible to bring that up, Mr. Operator. Can we bring up LK-18? Sorry, LK-118, I apologise. So this is a chain of emails, and if we go to page 2 of the chain, oh, I'm sorry, actually, that's my fault. If we go to page 1 of the chain, you see at the bottom of the page there's an email. If we blow it up, we'll see it's an email, and we'll just need to scroll up, Mr. Operator. It's an email from Ms. Allen back to Inspector Neville, and copied to Superintendent Freiberg and you?
Yes.
And it's dated the 16th of December, 2021, and it seems that it's Ms. Allen who is copying you into this chain of emails that's about what's going on in the with the DIFP results.
I was copied in around about that time, I believe. I think that conversation between the two of them had been going on before that date.
Yes, I understand. You were copied in at about this time. I'm interested in understanding, before you got copied in on the chain of emails, had you already discussed the issue with Ms. Allen?
No.
Had you discussed it with anyone?
This particular issue?
Yes.
I wasn't aware of it until then.
Okay, so the first time you became aware of it was when you were copied into a chain of emails?
I believe so.
And did you read the chain of emails then?
Yes.
And did you understand what it was about?
Not entirely, no.
Okay, but to some extent?
Vaguely, I would have to say.
Well, Ms. Keller, you have a scientific background.
I do.
Yes, but not in DNA profiling.
No.
But when you become the head of a body like FSS, which includes DNA profiling, I take it you didn't regard it as a necessary preparation for filling that role, that you should educate yourself on the science and technology of DNA profiling? At least you didn't do so, I gather.
I did not.
Because one would think that, as we lawyers have done, we're not scientists, in order to conduct this inquiry, we've had to educate ourselves in that subject. But you've been in management positions before, what did you regard as your role then if you would not be able to penetrate what you're being told in relation to the scientific craft? How would you be able to manage in some situations if you, as in the case of Ms. Ricker giving you a spreadsheet, which didn't mean anything to you, and I take it you really didn't understand the substance of her complaints, how could you manage if you don't have an adequate knowledge of the subject matter?
So my role, as I understand it or understood it at the time, was not to be the scientific expert in the various disciplines at FSS, of which there are perhaps seven. I don't think there is such a person who could be a specialist in every single aspect of FSS. I certainly have not portrayed myself as that. My understanding of my role at FSS is that I'm to lead the organisation. I'm not to, my role is not to be that scientific expert, because I have a team at FSS of those people who provide me with that advice. So I see my role as being overarching for the management of the campus. So that's what I think I've done.
Now, when you got copied into this chain of emails, if we go to the email at the top of the page, Mr. Operator, you knew from Inspector Neville's email that the issue was one that the QPS regarded as a high priority.
Yes.
And they were seeking advice as soon as possible.
Yes.
And I'm just trying to understand then what you understood the issue to be. I might take you to some parts of the email. Can we go to page 3? And can we blow up the email from Inspector Neville on the 3rd of December, which is in the middle of the page? So you understood that there was an issue that had arisen. I know it says 2008, but I'm assuming you realised it was 2018. An issue that had arisen about some decision that had been made in 2018?
Yes.
Did you understand what the decision was?
No.
Did you understand how the decision had come about?
No.
Did you seek to inform yourself as to what the decision was or how it had come about?
Not at that stage.
When you were copied into the chain of emails, after you read them, did you discuss it with Ms. Allen?
Not at that stage.
And could you just explain to us why not?
Because with regards to this particular inquiry, my understanding at that time was that Cathy and Inspector Neville's roles were essentially equivalent in terms of they were, you know, peers working on different projects. So I expected that Cathy would address those concerns without, you know, on behalf of that team.
But I just want to understand, you're copied into a chain of emails. You haven't been on the earlier emails, but it seems to have reached a point where somebody has decided you should be involved.
So it seems.
And it's not just that you're involved, it's also that the superintendent is involved.
Yes.
And having been copied into these emails on an issue that you'd not heard about before, you didn't make any inquiries as to what it was about.
I think I will have, there'll be records where I've spoken with Cathy about this particular, and that's why I called it, I can see now that it's referred to as the operation there. That's how I referred to with her, and I did have conversations with Cathy about the progress of that request.
I see. So you did have conversations with Ms. Allen about what the request was about and how it was going?
Yes, and that'll be part of my statement, the different diary notes that, from the meetings that I had with Cathy.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a moment. Can we blow up the email at the bottom of the page? So you see, this is an email from Ms. Allen to Inspector Neville, and you'll see that Ms. Allen says in that large paragraph, after we had conducted a review of the large data set, it was found that below a particular quantitation threshold and in line with manufacturer specifications, a very small percentage of samples may provide some type of DNA profile if they proceeded through DNA processing. Do you remember whether you discussed with Ms. Allen what the data set was or what the percentage was that was providing a DNA profile?
Not at that stage.
But at some stage?
Yes.
When was that?
Oh, I don't recall exactly when that was.
Okay. You see that she then goes on to say, this information was provided to the QPS and the QPS advised that it would prefer that those samples that didn't exceed the quant threshold were not processed through to a DNA profile. We've monitored this and have found that with a larger data set, the small percentage didn't vary.
I can see that, yes.
And have you ever discussed with Ms. Allen what this larger data set was or the monitoring was?
Oh, subsequently.
When?
When I became... I can't recall exact dates, when I became aware of that options paper.
I see. And so did you ascertain from Ms. Allen whether or not there had been further monitoring of a larger data set?
Not at that stage. I became aware based upon Inspector Neville's request that another data extract was going to be assessed, but not at that stage.
Okay. I suppose we'll come to those emails in a moment, but is what you're referring to that Ms. Allen said it would be necessary to extract data from the forensic register?
In response to the request from Inspector Neville, that was what I understood, yes.
But you see though in this email, what Ms. Allen is saying is we've monitored this and have found that with a larger data set, the small percentage didn't vary. Have you ever been told what that monitoring was or what this larger data set was that showed that the small percentage didn't vary?
No.
Did you ever ask her about it?
No.
Okay. And then if we go to page 2, and can we blow up the text of that email, which you'll see is an email from Inspector Neville to Ms. Allen. Now, this is the email immediately before you get copied in. So I'm assuming you would have read this email at the time.
Yes, but yes. And that doesn't mean I understood the detail at the time.
You may not have understood the detail. I'm just trying to understand what you understood, if anything. You see that in the first sentence, it says, since sending you my last message, I found some correspondence from February 2018 where QHFSS made a recommendation to QPS that testing of samples that contained less than 0.008 nanograms per microliter of DNA should discontinue because the chance of obtaining a profile was less than 2%. And then if you look in the last, then the rest of the email talks about further testing, but you see the last full sentence from Inspector Neville says, I think the 30% success rate of retesting warrants a little further examination to make sure we are maximising our chances of solving crime, particularly for major crime matters.
Yes.
And did you understand that, that is back in December of last year, that there was an issue that apparently samples were not being tested below a certain threshold on the premise that there was a less than 2% chance of obtaining a profile, but more recent testing had shown a 30% success rate?
At that time, I was being told that, and subsequent to that, I was being told that the 1.86% was the figure in question, and that there was a safety net in that at any time a scientist or a member of the police service could request full testing. So I didn't really understand the 30% success rate because I was being presented with the 1.86 on a regular basis with that caveat that essentially nothing is missed. So.
But just for a moment, just focus your attention on December of last year when, as I understand your evidence, this issue gets raised with you for the first time by being copied into emails. That's right?
Yes.
And
I think so.
The emails that are identifying the issue are identifying that on the one hand, a decision seems to have been made on the basis that the chance of obtaining a profile was less than 2%, but on the other hand, more recent retesting by police had shown a 30% success rate. And you must have at least understood that from reading the email, that that was an issue, that there was a difference between the very low original percentage and the much higher percentage that the police were now finding.
Not at that time, I did not.
I don't understand. How could you not have understood that if you'd read the email?
I did not understand that at the time.
Okay. And you understood, tell me then if you understood at least this, that the issue of concern to police was about whether a process had been put in place that was not maximising the chance of solving crime, particularly for major crime matters.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Yes. You understood that the issue that was being raised by police was whether a process had been put in place that was not maximising the chance of solving crime, particularly for major crime matters.
I did not put that into context at the time because I was under the impression that a review was going to be done and, again, that there was no cases that were going to be compromised. That's what I was continually told.
Sorry. Before we go into what you understood as the response that might have come from Ms. Allen or somebody else, I just want you to focus on what you understood was the issue that was being raised by police.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand you're saying in December of last year you didn't understand the idea of a very low percentage versus 30%. I'm interested in understanding whether, even at a more general level, you understood that the concern being raised by police was that a process had been put in place that was not maximising the chance of solving crime, particularly for major crimes.
I did not understand that at that time.
And again, doing the best you can for us, if you How could you not have understood that?
That question's almost impossible to answer.
Exactly.
Hodge.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Is that a convenient time for a break? We'll resume at 11:45.
Rise.